A special day at the State House. Lawmakers finally wrap up 2018 legislation. Senate Republicans choose a new pro tem. That, plus Donnelly backs Trump's CIA nominee and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 18th, 2018.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, lawmakers approved five measures during their one-day special session after they couldn't finish the job during the regular session.
Republican leaders sought to tightly control the special session, limiting it to five bills: two tax measures, school safety legislation, a technical corrections bill, and Gary Muncy's school takeover legislation. That last bill was the most controversial. It eliminates elected school boards in both of those financially distressed school districts while giving control of the Muncy school system to Ball State University. It also creates fiscal indicators to monitor financial conditions in all school districts for warning signs. Critics argue it could lead to more district takeovers. Proponents say it's designed precisely to avoid that.
Was the special session a successful one? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwann is the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and political analyst John Ketzenberger. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, lawmakers checked off the boxes they wanted to check off, so is it job well done?
You're kidding, aren't you?
I'm not. I'm asking if it's job well done.
You know, what's amazing about this is we had the stories about it cost $30,000, and we had these couple of other bills they had in there. The real purpose of this legislative special session was so they could go behind closed doors and decide what parts of the federal tax code changes they were not going to conform with and save their friends tens of millions of dollars without any public discussion to speak of it. I mean, that's what this was designed to do. It was all done in caucus. It was all done in secret. And people benefited to the tunes of tens of millions of dollars, while our teachers are still now getting paid 23% less now than they were 10 years ago, and on, and the roads are in terrible condition, and on and on and on. But they could come back in for this and give away tens of millions of dollars to corporations who already got a substantial federal tax break, and do it all in secret. And you think they should get an award for that, Brandon?
I was just asking you a question.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Well, I was not saying one way or the other.
Clarify that, yes. The answer is no. They ought to get an F.
I'm guessing you have a different opinion, Mike O'Brien.
That was the Democrats' line on the floor. They couldn't really point to anything. They just looked at the bill and said, I don't understand this, I don't understand this, I don't understand this. We need to study all this, and we'll do it all next session. We need to do it. Fundamentally, these bills were in the shape they were in the last day of session, and through that second half of the process, mm-hmm. when these tax bills were negotiated, heard in public hearing, taken testimony on the floor, and then heard again in conference committee. So there was plenty of daylight on these bills through the process. The fundamental problem here was they just ran out of time. They were getting these bills in final form, and that's not ideal. Let's not just say, hey, this was great, and you know. What surprised me most, I think, is how mishandled it was by Democrats. It was pretty, I mean, we were in at 9 and out at 3, and everybody went home. And
yeah, you did it all in caucus.
You watched the news coverage of it.
You did it all in secret.
It sounded like we did everybody a favor, which we didn't. We should have gotten this done during the regular session. We didn't. Legislature was going to be in session that day. Likely anyway, because of the technical corrections bill, which was the one
passed,
bill that was not considered in the regular
session. The
bills
that passed in session had tens of millions of dollars difference in the way the tax code was treating those corporations. So they didn't pass
those
and just
actually
not
didn't
get...
Pass. That was why we had the special
not
session.
Not in both houses, they didn't. And they passed in different variations in each house. And you guys go behind closed doors and you decide to even it all out however your friends want it. And there was not
debate
about that.
That's a nice straw, man. It's just not true.
Oh, it absolutely is.
There were five measures considered. He talked about the technical corrections bill was the one that didn't come for the regular session, obviously. It was reacting to bills actually passed during the regular session. But then you had the school safety bill, the school takeover bill. If the tax measures had passed, would we have been in for a special session?
No.
In the regular session? Or was it really mostly about the tax bills?
Probably the tax bills. I mean, there's an expectation, I think, generally, when federal tax code is changed dramatically, that state law will follow suit. Just.
But they didn't.
Somewhat.
They did in some
somewhat.
Ways.
They recognized that it had changed,
right.
And they needed to change with it. The biggest concern, I think, among leadership, and one of the motivators for the session was the notion that, gee, now you're going to have to do everything, you know, your whatever software program you're going to have to do your taxes simply, and you know, be out and back to playing around in an hour ain't going to work because everything this hasn't changed. There's no compatibility. So I think there was impetus driven by...
They didn't make it compatible with the federal system.
They recognized the issues, and they were right. There was picking and choosing.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, you should be careful. You were criticizing the roads. There was a tax break for hot asphalt.
Wow.
There was an
tax break.
It extended the current treatment of that.
Well,
that
process. But that's
saved any money.
So
just prevented the taxes from going up in a year.
Don't bash the asphalt. You know.
Let me ask this. That, as I mentioned in the piece, the most controversial of these was arguably not the tax bills.
That's because nobody knew it happened.
They were loaded to bear and confusing to a lot of people, including a lot of lawmakers themselves, quite frankly. But the most controversial was the school takeover bill.
Right.
Did lawmakers need to do that one?
No, they didn't need to do that one. There was already a mechanism in place to deal with school districts that are in financial distress. But for more than a year now, there has been focus. Gary has been the focus of lawmakers for a long time. Muncie came into their sights about a year ago, and they were bound and determined to establish this new protocol and give these new powers to the Distress Unit Appeals Board and essentially create a watch list to try to figure out what school districts might be in similar financial straits or not. It's a wide-ranging bill. It didn't need to be done, but they had the opportunity and they decided to do it. It's got a lot of implications. It's a little bit sloppy. I was kind of surprised by some of the exemptions that are in the bill that seem to be just, you know, kind of clerical errors, if you will. And if they're not, then they're interesting political statements. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how this goes, you know, when it goes, it takes effect and how it... plays out, because it makes some pretty wide-ranging changes that have some big implications and essentially centers control of schools more and firmly in the state level.
Fundamentally, if you believe that and you can disagree on the approach and how they're intervening in Muncie and Gary, fundamentally, if you believe that is going to help solve that problem and it wasn't a priority for this special session, then you're ultimately saying, well, we're just going to let them fail at to an extraordinary degree for 16 more months until we can get back into session, pass this bill in largely the same way that we already crafted it and debated it through the session, and we'll just waste another 16 months.
If that's the case, but...
You can disagree on the approach, but if you fundamentally believe the underlying motivation for it, then delaying it made no sense at all.
Well, I don't disagree with your reasoning, but I do disagree with the level of imperative here, especially with the Muncie situation. I think that got politicized, frankly, and I think that it hadn't reached the level of catastrophe that for, you know, the already established protocols. And so you could make the argument that there wasn't the necessity. Now, I understand that the legislators and others determined that was the case and they needed to act, but I'm not sure that was the case under the old protocol.
Well, and you had broad community buy into that solution, too.
It wasn't universal. But
it wasn't universal.
All right. Shortly after they completed the special session this week, Senate Republicans elected Martinsville's Rod Bray as their pick to replace David Long as Senate President pro tem.
When Senator David Long announced his impending retirement earlier this year, he said he wanted his caucus to choose a new leader early to give him time to mentor his replacement. That vote came Monday, as the caucus, behind closed doors, chose Rod Bray over Markle Senator Travis Holdman. The vote wasn't unanimous, but Bray says he's confident the caucus will be united going forward. Joining Bray in the leadership bid was Jasper Senator Mark Messmer, who will become the majority floor leader, Bray's current position.
Mike O'Brien, is Rod Bray the best choice?
I think he is a great choice. They had a lot of options in that caucus. The two were kind of four in the leadership race there. I think they picked well, and they picked in a way that's forward-looking. Bray's just kind of in the middle of his second term. He kind of comes by it naturally, though. His father, of course, was in the legislature for a long time prior to that. Young, talented guy, though. If he chooses to be there for a long time, I think he will. I think it's a great pick for the Senate, and I think especially – the way this race was run, there's really no fallout from this. You know, everybody had a chance to win. Senator Holdman maintains, you know, what is really the most powerful position, second most powerful chairmanship in the
Tax and fiscal policy. Yeah. Does Rob Bray shift in your mind the ideology of that caucus in any particular direction, or is it pretty much on the same footing?
I'm not sure it shifts the ideology. I think another choice may have shifted the ideology, but I think Bray is a good choice. I think he's a reasonable, or appears to be a reasonable legislator who can work across the aisle, and those are good characteristics. It seems to be driven by more by common sense and the desire to get something done rather than some radical ideology like some of the members of that caucus. So I think he's a really good choice.
So and endorsed by Ann Delaney.
He's already elected.
Rod Bray's really in trouble now.
It's not official.
That's true.
Let's just slow down here.
He's terrible.
Save this endorsement for December.
Bray was speaking to the press afterwards, said that he had won by a comfortable margin, but that even the caucus didn't know the actual results that had been counted. Like, you know, oh, okay, it's clear that it's Rod Bray. Whether or not that's true, do you think everything is, you know, okay in the Senate Republican caucus?
I think the Senate Republican caucus is a fractious group. And I mean by that, I don't mean that in a pejorative manner. It's just that there are several various, you know, mini caucuses within the larger caucus and a lot of different interests and ideologies. And I think that Rod Bray is going to be challenged to manage that. He has the advantage of being new. He has the advantage of being able to take it slow, but he will have a challenge because he has so many members. That's the thing about a supermajority, is that it's harder to maintain discipline within the caucus because you can afford to have so many free agents. And they have a lot of free agents, so it'll be interesting to see how he manages that. But, you know, I think he's got a good shot at doing it.
This was obviously a meteoric rise for Rod Bray. The path laid forward by Brant Hirschman's departure from the Senate technically at the end of last year, just before the session started. So is he ready for a job this big, having only been in the Senate for less than two full terms?
You could probably spin it as a positive, as Mike suggested. It's this notion that, and whether that's on I doubt that's a plank in his platform, if you will. Hey, I've only been here a term and a half, so I'm your guy. But why not make it a positive in the spin? And I do think, as silly as it sounds, being a legacy, legislative legacy, even though he was not there in his own right, he gets like half credit for those years, or maybe third credit. So I think he'll be up to it. And as far as the any friction, one benefit they had was, to the extent there was a fight, and I'm not saying there necessarily was a heated fight, but if there was, it was all behind closed doors. I mean, this was not a repeat, for instance, of the Republican primary in the U.S. Senate primary, where it's easier to hurt someone's pride and have them dug in and seek retribution when you're not outing them or, you know, calling them names in front of
lots of
6-7 million Hoosiers. Yeah.
That Senate primary is so last week.
That's right.
Thank God we're unified.
It's time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: will Rod Bray, as Senate President Pro Tem, ideologically shift the Senate Republican caucus? A, yes, further to the right. B, yes, towards the center. Or C, no, it will remain the same. Last week's question: will Republican Mike Braun beat Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly this fall? 20% say yes, 69% say no, and 11% say it's a little too early to tell. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Senator Joe Donnelly became the second Democrat to publicly announce his support for President Trump's nominee for CIA Director Gina Haspel. Haspel has been sharply criticized for her role in the Bush administration's enhanced interrogation program, considered by many to be torture. Donnelly met with Haspel last week and had what he describes as a tough, frank conversation with her. He says he believes she's, quote, learned from her past. Donnelly says Haspel also pledged to provide what he calls unvarnished assessments to both Congress and the president. The Hoosier senator was the second Democrat to publicly back Haspel. Others have since joined him.
John Katzenberger, did Donnelly essentially have to do this with a re-election fight looming?
Well, I think that there's a school of thought that given Indiana's Republican nature and the president's success here in the 2016 election, that may be the case. there were a lot of Republicans, not a lot. There were several Republicans who had questions about her fitness for the role.
And ultimately voted against her.
But, you know, he was performing his duty as a senator, and he had his interview with her, and he made his decision. It gives him difficulty with a lot of the more progressive Democrats in Indiana, and it does really outline the difficult nature of the line he's got to walk, because he needs to bring in a lot of Republicans and a lot of moderates, but he also needs to maintain a base of the Democrat Party that is more progressive than he is. And so he may have thought that he needed to do that to help this, or he may have done it because he thinks that's the right thing to do. But it's going to make it a little more difficult for him to hold his base together.
Was this the best political choice for Joe Donnelly? I'm not saying that's why he did it, but was it the best political choice?
Maybe, since it wouldn't have mattered in the end how he voted, right? Why set yourself up for criticism if your stance is not going to make a difference? And that's a cowardly way, I guess, to frame it. But
this is Congress.
But he wasn't going to make a difference. The only caution, I guess, I would have, to the extent that he's portraying himself and his campaign is portraying him as the maverick, you know, I'm not going to be in lockstep with you or with you.
He works
for Hoosiers. But if between now and the time people go to the polls, he just so happens to vote only for whatever the White House
wants.
But it would sure suggest that there's that the maverick label means something different.
It's not going to happen.
Donnelly's used some of the votes like this. Has cited some of votes like this as evidence that he's not just a Democrat or just anything. The day after the election, he talked about his votes for Mike Pompeo and for Neil Gorsuch as reasons why that he votes the way Hoosiers want him to vote. Is this another in that case file he's got?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're seeing a pattern here. You could ask the question: what do West Virginia, North Dakota, Indiana, and Florida have in common? They're all battleground U.S. Senate states, and they're going to be Democrats voting with the president from here to the end on high profile things like that. I thought John Ketzenberger's point was, I thought his analysis was right. I don't know what for progressives. I don't know what a tough conversation is for Joe Donnelly. I guess it's tell her don't go torture people, or I'm going to be upset, but I'm going to vote for you. He's got to have it both ways. He's got to go tell the progressives he's with them. Then he's got to go remind the rest of the Hoosiers 60% of the time he's with the president, which he also did.
62%.
I'm not sure he really does.
How tight a line does Joe Donnelly have to walk between now and November?
I think it's a difficult line. There's no question about that. But I had a conversation with him years and years and years ago before Donald Trump, praise God, was ever on the scene. And his position has always been that if the whoever's the president has a right to have people around him in cabinet positions that he or she has confidence in, as long as they're qualified. And that was the caveat that he always put, as long as they're qualified. There's no question that she's qualified. The issue of torture, I think, was resolved to his satisfaction, that it would not be used again, despite Donald Trump's rhetoric on that part. And then, consistent with the ideology that he's followed for years and years, he was going to go and vote for her,
he can ignore the base and do this for the middle, or the Trump voter in the middle.
I think he can, because they don't have anywhere else to go. Yeah. I mean, there's such an antipathy
They're not going to vote for a Republican. Mike Braun's a Democrat, too. Maybe they will.
So was Donald Trump. Thank God he isn't any longer.
Indiana lawmakers unveiled this year's study committee topics this week, revealing they'll consider a number of controversial issues, including hate crimes and the Department of Child Services.
The four legislative caucus leaders vote to determine which topics will be studied. House Speaker Brian Bosma says he's not sure hate crimes, bills for which have repeatedly failed the last few years, need to be studied any further. Issues at the Department of Child Services are also on the agenda after an independent investigation wraps up next month. House Democratic leader Terry Gooden says a focus of his caucus will be local, frontline DCS workers. Other controversial topics this year: medical marijuana, sports wagering, and alcohol laws.
John Schwannis, are you surprised by the weighty agenda, considering this is an election year?
Well, if you look at the issues that are looming, I would say these are probably the most important ones that promise to be the most contentious and may require the most analysis and study before any kind of consensus is reached. So, I guess from one standpoint, surprised or not, those are the issues probably that they should be studying.
Are you suggesting they were being responsible?
I don't want, let's not go crazy. But
if they were responsible, they would have already dealt with these issues.
I think we just need to remember this word of caution. If, in fact, a study committee were obviously for the first stage in sort of some irreversible path to passage of legislation, that'd be one thing, but that ain't the case.
Yeah.
Even if who's to say what once they study it, what they'll recommend? Because even if they recommend something, a lot of those things get left on the cutting room floor as well.
And that's if they recommend something,
right,
which increasingly they seem not to do. What do you make of the fact that hate crimes is on the list? Even Speaker Bosma seemed a little surprised. Not that he's for or against it. He's actually said that he's for a hate crimes law now, but he said basically it came down to what is the point of studying this again?
Because you don't want to deal with it. That's what the point is.
Well, and that
I haven't
maybe
asked that question to you. And
that well may be the answer. I think that is, there are a lot of arguments you can be made about the DCS and about the marijuana, medical marijuana situation, but clearly hate crimes has been legislation several years in a row now. You're either for it or against it. There may be some details that need to be worked out in the middle, but that can be done in the usual legislative process. So I'm, like the speaker, kind of baffled by why that's there, and I don't really understand it. They're either going to do it or they're not, and so far they haven't.
This, the way the study committees are decided is three of the four legislative leaders have to vote for it. Presumably, bias crimes got votes from both Democrats, and if Brian Bosma said he wasn't really sure why they were doing it, it would suggest that David Long voted for that to become a study committee topic. Is he trying? He talked last session about he wanted to see it come back in 2019. Is this about just keeping that issue alive as much as possible?
It probably was, because John's absolutely right. It doesn't have to be studied anymore. You either vote for it or you don't think that there's any difference in somebody being killed or maimed or attacked because of race or gender or sexual orientation. It's about time that we were progressive enough. I mean, we lag behind in this state on so many issues. I mean, so many issues, it's embarrassing. On voter turnout, on voter participation, on obesity, on quality of life, on everything. And it seems to me that the very basic thing that we will tolerate people no matter what their backgrounds are, it just seems so basic that I can't really understand why anybody's opposed to it.
A lot of controversial issues in pretty much any committee that'll be talking this summer. Any lawmakers who are going to be a little unhappy to have to study some of these things in the midst of electoral battles?
Well, maybe, but remember, this interim study committee process sets up the next session, which is a long session that's after the election. So if they're going to tee these things up, they have no choice but to talk about them this summer and into the fall on bias crimes. I think the only thing I'll say about that, I'm for it. I agree that it doesn't need to be studied in terms of new information coming out, but there is value in keeping that conversation above the surface. So you do have legislators who maybe won't be against it or undecided, get more comfortable with it, and maybe hear something that'll move them to the other side.
Well, a key Senate committee chair says legislation to legalize sports betting in Indiana will get a hearing next session after this week's Supreme Court decision that allows states to authorize such wagering.
Republican Representative Alan Morrison wrote a bill this year that would have legalized sports wagering if, say, the Supreme Court sanctioned it in all 50 states. It didn't even get a hearing, but now Morrison says he's hopeful for progress. Senate Public Policy Committee Chair Ron Alting says he'll give a hearing to a bill next year to legalize sports betting. Alting and Morrison say they anticipate neighboring states will move forward with sports wagering.
And Delaney, should Hoosiers get the right to bet on sports?
Well, I think what will happen with this is a lot like what happened when the lottery came. I mean, other states around us and through the Midwest adopted it, and either we got the revenue source or people went over the border to do it. So I think something will come, and I think the monopoly that Nevada has on betting on professional gambling will come. I just hope we don't get carried away with the NCAA here and start betting on college sports or the Haverford Little League tournament and things like that. I hope we keep it at the professional level.
Is the NCAA going to be the biggest sticking point in the discussion that's had in this state?
Well, I think they issued a temporary – they lifted their ban – temporarily, anyway, on locating events in states that do this, right?
And they better, or they're not going to go anywhere.
They're going to be out of the parking lot.
I think there's some details to figure out. I think between Sunday sales and sports betting, it's a great time to be alive in Indiana.
Very quickly, by this time next year, will sports betting be legal in Indiana?
probably. I don't think Indiana can afford to lose potential revenue.
All right. I think that's right, too.
Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and political analyst John Katzenberger. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.